can't really believe that it's been 6 weeks, really, since we had our first Buddhist Women's Retreat at Green Gulch Farm, embodying our wild feminine spirits. 14 women registered for this retreat: Karen Hamilton, Katrina Payne, Valerie Small Navarro, Valerie Hansen, Cherie Spring, Malia McCarthy, Sarah O'Gara, Jody Ansel, Susan Farrar, Andrea Georgie, who's here on Zoom, Patty Dower, Barbara Bechet, and Simone Bowers. Simone was unable to come, so we were 13 in person, but she was with us in spirit, and I see she's here with us tonight. It was really an amazing event for all of us to come together in the ways that we did. And I think our deep connections and our awakenings maybe are still reverberating amongst all of us. And I look forward to not only speaking, but opening up a discussion amongst all of us. And for those of us who were at the retreat, to share your own reflections as they seem to arise. So my plan is, I've been sort of encouraged to offer the frame of the retreat that I kind of laid out at the beginning. And then after that, much was more was co-created as we went along. But it might be helpful just to bring everybody in and to consider some of the themes and the ideas that we were working with on the retreat. And to begin with, we were very fortunate because we had the whole guest house all to ourselves. So we had a comfortable place to live, to sleep, and to wake up and to hang out. And we also had Stillwater Hall, which is a very large, what was originally a yoga room, but has a lot of space and lots of windows. And we had that all to ourselves also for the whole weekend. So we could set it up with yoga mats and zafus and zabutans and chairs. And Barbara and I created an altar, a very large altar, where we had our own Prajnaparamita on the altar, the mother of all Buddhas. We had Kuan Yin, we had Jiso statues. We had a bowl with earth on our altar. And this is how we began to bring Prajnaparamita into our midst, who's the mother of all Buddhas and who carries the sutras on her shoulder, as many of you were connected to at the retreat this weekend or last weekend. And from these sutras that are on her shoulders, the Hymn to the Perfection of Wisdom emerged, the Heart Sutra emerged. The many faces of Avalokiteshvara evolved from the sutra, so her presence was with us every day. And really what's most important is that she was really emanating, that we can embody the Dharma. We can live from our whole being the Dharma in our everyday life. So we were all invited to live with these questions. How do we awaken to our embodiments? What does it mean to live wild and actualize the feminine and consider this to be essential to our spiritual lives? So we're going to continue asking these questions tonight. So consider this an invitation for all of you to be seeing what comes up for you as we explore some of these questions. And I just want to begin with the body, and just ask the question even, what is the body? And on one level, that we are embodied is obvious. I mean, we wouldn't be alive if we don't breathe, rest, sleep, eat, sit, touch, make things with our hands, express love, passion, hatred, anger, fear, joy, gratitude. All of this is what it means to be human, to also live with death and loss and the impermanence of everything. This is something that we experience on a bodily level. But beyond all of this, it seems to me that underneath all of these factors of our living, if we are fully alive in the moment and our whole being is involved in our life, we're not really thinking, we're living. And that kind of living is actually rooting us in the wholeness of everything. And so there's a wisdom body that can come through the body. So all of this we can open into, and in the context of a culture where reason and objectivity and linear thinking is what's most important. We're surrounded by it wherever we go. Most people on the Supreme Court think they can be just objective. But these mental processes we want to pay attention to because they support detachment. They support being sort of dissociated from our bodily living. And this is why this way of thinking, this way of being becomes a justification to exploit the earth for profit. It becomes the way to objectify and other people. So this disengagement from life is also a disengagement from the interconnectedness of all beings. So we were offering, as part of our intention for our retreat, is to awaken our embodied energies, to let go of the abstract, to let go of always needing to explain or label, and then to see what's directly arising in the moment from our bodily experience. Maybe there's a lot of different ways we could think of the body or give a definition of the body, but I want to offer one that my mentor, Eugene Genlin, articulated. And he says, the physically felt body is in fact part of a gigantic system of here and other places, now and other times, you and other people. In fact, the physically felt body is the whole universe. So this sense of being bodily alive in a vast system of everything is the body as it's felt from the inside. So I understand this to be saying that by cultivating a capacity to be attuned to the bodily level of our life force, that we will in that same moment be completely connected to everything that is. So it's the doorway into being open to all that's arising, all that's available to us. So to kind of demonstrate maybe some of these pathways, like we're wanting to cultivate a capacity to listen to our embodiedness. So I shared this story at the retreat, and it's actually about a former client of mine and when I was functioning as a psychologist. And I've disguised all identifying information, so I think it's okay to share this particular experience because it demonstrates maybe the potential of beginning to understand the language of the body. This is somebody who, as a child, experienced a lot of physical abuse, and as a teenager, sexual abuse. She grew up in a household where even though her mother knew what was going on, she didn't really do anything. But during her whole childhood, every Sunday, her mother took her to the church, a Methodist church. And, they would go religiously to the services, and there was something about her mother taking her to the church that connected her to something deeper, something more whole, and it really kind of saved her in a way. I mean, because she had enough inner resources then to go on with her adult life and have children and go to college and develop a profession, and she still found a job at this church that she grew up in. But something happened. There was a crisis in the church, and some unethical behavior, and she felt she had to leave the church. And she came to our session, and she was very despairing and hopeless, afraid that she would lose her faith. And we, you know, in my office, there was a table, and on the table was a vase with peonies, peony flowers. And I just walked into my office, and my colleague had put them there, so they were just there. But I was listening to her, and all the time she was talking, her eyes kept looking towards the peonies. And it wasn't just once I would look back, and she was looking at the peonies. And so finally I said, are you aware that you keep looking at the peonies? And she goes, what? She had no awareness that this was what was happening in her body, that she was looking at the peonies. So as soon as I called her attention to that, she goes, oh, peonies were my mother's favorite flower. And she started crying. And she said, oh my God, I think I'm going to be okay. That somehow she could feel that her faith would be sustained even though she would leave this church. So it was very striking to me that her eyes, her body, basically, was moving her towards the wisdom of something healing, and she had no idea. So it's sort of like we don't necessarily cultivate these capacities in ourselves to listen to our bodies in this way. But the other uncanny thing was that my colleague had, the day before, brought these particular flowers to the table. I mean, what was that? What was going on that moved her body to cut those flowers and bring them here, too? So this is kind of what, I guess, a direction or something of what to cultivate. Like, we want to cultivate eye consciousness, you know, listening consciousness, touch consciousness, you know, the elements, the feeling of the wind and the earth and all of these other dimensions of life that our bodies directly experience by, I guess, cultivating what I call attuned attention. I mean, we can pay attention to many different ways, you know, I don't know, I was talking to somebody earlier. Well, I never noticed those plants there until today. How long have they been there? I mean, we don't pay attention to everything. And sometimes our attention gets very focused on one kind of thing. And so this attuned attention is a different kind of attention where we are actually intentionally noticing, you know, what our body's doing, what it's trying to say to us. And so if we cultivate that, it's kind of what this definition of the body says. We become attuned not only to what's happening within us, but in that kind of direct connection, we're also directly connecting with the energy of everything. So then the wisdom can come through. So maybe we could just pause for a moment and just kind of wonder for a moment what you would notice if you just let your body sway a little bit. Don't make it sway. That's a subtle thing. Maybe your body doesn't want to sway. Just see what it's like. And then just gently bring your attention down into a direct awareness of your whole body. And see where your awareness takes you. What do you notice? Not a story or a label, but sort of like an adjective or an image. What calls your attention? And just offer that one word or that one phrase of being attuned to your body. And I thank Malia for this idea. It could be something like tingly or tight hands. A breath. I invite you to offer it out loud if you want, and maybe staying in the silence is also what's right now.
Pounding.
Grounding.
Chi. Wrists.
Shaky. Breathing. Silence. Yeah. Just even notice what it's like to bring your attention inside in this way. Another sort of important offering about this bodily language is to notice how we interact with our emotions. And often we name our emotions based on sort of social customary ways of naming emotion. And we get caught in, oh, well, you know, I'm just anxious today. Or we kind of flippantly name an emotion or a feeling. But that's not the same as actually coming into the body and sensing it. Because often these emotions don't really capture what's going on in our bodies. And so we have to kind of let go of those labels, really, to discover. I had one experience where I'd had an interaction with somebody and, you know, I thought, oh, I'm just really angry. But when I said that to myself, nothing really stirred or happened inside. So then I began to notice, oh, I feel sort of teary behind my eyes and my hands are sweaty and I'm tight in my stomach. And then, oh, I'm enraged. And just to say I'm enraged, I could feel it all over my body. And there was a release because it was like I'm living, I'm letting myself actually experience what it is. And after saying that back to myself, I felt the release. And then you can be with the energy that's released. It's no longer caught in the feeling itself. There's a woman named Brisha Wade who wrote a book called Grieving While Black. And she was a NICU chaplain and a Buddhist. And she worked especially with Black women mothers who had recently given birth, and she noticed that many, you know, staff and so forth would label these Black women as they're so angry, you know, and angry in the sense of there's that stereotype, you know, Black women are angry. But Brisha, she did her own attending inside to her body and what it felt like to be with these women. Sort of noticing on a bodily level, not the language, but what it felt like to be with these women. And suddenly she felt agony. It's not rage, it's agony. And out of that sense of she could feel compassion for the women and also more accurately connected. So during our retreat, this theme of anger came up for many of us. And so it clearly is important as women to learn more about how to be with our anger and what it even means. And so we began to at least consider the phrase, holy rage, you know, as a way of really honoring that experience to get underneath it more. And we also talked about shame, because shame too is a very bodily, emotional experience. We often hold our breath when we're feeling ashamed. We're ashamed and don't feel like we're valuable human beings. Some people get red skin. People get stiff when they're feeling shame. Shame for needing something. And so that too was something we explored. And then as the retreat went on, because really, if we hold tight to any particular feeling, we're also suppressing all the other feelings. Because feelings want to be free to flow from maybe deep down hatred and anger to bliss. And to be able to have that capacity to be that open and that moving with emotion, you know, this is part of what it means to listen to the language of the body. And so as our retreat unfolded, we were laughing, we were playful, we did improvisation, we did koan theater, you know, so much of our expressiveness and creativity came through through all of these dimensions of emotion, but playfulness and laughter. We did an art project that Karen Hamilton led where we also listened to the language of the body. She had us close our eyes and let our hands just move on the paper and then to see what happened. So that was another sort of avenue into discovering the language of the body. And this includes all the elements, like just to spend time feeling the wind on your skin, or spend some time noticing the different qualities of your breath, what it's like to touch the water, but especially the earth. I mean, I know this is true here too, but I was very struck at Green Gulch Farm, the Ohlone Native peoples and the coastal Miwok peoples. They have lived on that land for 10,000 years. I mean, to me, that's incredible, because that tells me that the earth carries wisdom from our ancestors. But we have to learn to listen to the earth. We're not trying to save the earth. We're trying to listen to the earth and let the earth tell us what it needs. So what ended up happening too was we invited everybody that came on the retreat to bring a symbol of a woman ancestor in their life that had an impact on the story of their life and who they've become. And so, I mean, in general, this connection with the earth also elicits the power of ancestors and the importance of ancestors to stay connected. And so each person brought a symbol of a woman ancestor, and we had like a real, we didn't know it was going to be a ceremony. This is part of the co-creation of the weekend, that each of us ended up coming up to the altar, offering our symbol to the altar, and then sharing the story of this ancestor in their lives. And this is part of the transmission that was happening between us, because we each could feel, you know, the gifts that each of us received from our ancestors. So we awaken through our bodies. We become attuned to the universe. And of course, Barbara was our wonderful teacher of yoga. We had yoga every day, and I know we wished we'd had more yoga. And I don't think she's there, so... And that was another embodied practice, to do the yoga before we would sit and to discover what happens when our body gets opened up through the yoga and how that affects our sitting experience itself. And so all of these different dimensions, I mean, in the Prajnaparamita, it basically says, there is no fixed way. There is no way, one path to follow. As Lex Hickson says, this sutra rejects any finite, systematic technique of meditation, deftly eliminating even the slightest conceptualized approach, because this is a teaching without any path. So this kind of invoking of a deeply sensed inside embodied way is offered by the Prajnaparamita. So maybe you can already feel a little bit of what we might mean by wild, because this was embodying our wild feminine spirits. And at least what Barbara and I were offering was, by wild, we mean that which is beyond human construction, that which cannot fit into any category. You know, when we practice the paramitas, we're already being called to leap out of any protocol, because each moment is asking something particular from us. And actually, the wild is unbridled nature. Nature itself is an expression of wild. And anything that goes beyond our social conditioning. So wildness is the essence of Dharma working through us and in us without hindrance or revealing our hindrances, to learn and to let go. So I have to check the time, because I guess the most challenging, I think, and maybe exciting part of this whole stream of embodying our wild feminine spirit is, well, what is feminine spirit? So I'm going to offer some things, and I realized as I was going over this again that a lot of what I want to say is evocative. It's not, you know, the answer exactly. It's meant to make us wonder, how does this come forth in our own lives? And yet the evocative perspective, I think, could open up a lot for all of us. Because the first thing is, it's important to not define feminine within the duality of male and female. That's exactly not what we want to be doing. Rather, to understand the feminine as an archetypal energy that's not dependent on biological sex or gender constructs at all. So this feminine arises from the earth, like we've already talked about, so that the energy comes from down under, up, and through, and around. And this is what brings so much creative energy forth for expression. So I don't know if you've heard of the French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan. It's probably an esoteric person, but for many people. But anyway, he coined the term mystical feminine souissance. Mystical feminine souissance. And what he meant by this is an experience of embodied feminine energy as sensuous, bliss, pleasure, mystical interconnectedness with all of life, with both a bearable and unbearable quality, and a whole body eroticism. So just notice whatever reactions you have to this coming up. So, bearable, unbearable, this is more my take on what this means, is the mystical ability to bear unbearable suffering. That's the truth of human existence. To stay right there on this energetic level with a compassionate presence that also sustains our passionate love of life. So it's this actually, you know, complete interconnection of the energetic compassion that arises in us for all beings and all suffering. And at the same time, there is present and available a passionate love for life. I don't know if you've heard of Audre Lorde, some of you. No? Audre Lorde is an American writer, professor, philosopher, intersectional feminist, poet, and civil rights activist. She lived in 1934 to 1992. And she says, the erotic is a resource within each of us that lies in a deeply female and spiritual plane, firmly rooted in the power of our unexpressed or unrecognized feeling. The erotic is a resource within each of us that lies in a deeply female spiritual plane, rooted in the power of our unexpressed or unrecognized feeling. Now, I kind of connect this to what we're saying about being connected on a bodily level, you know, that there's so much more there that has been sort of suppressed or repressed in the kind of culture that we've been raised in, that wants to come alive, that wants to be listened to, and that has a kind of power. Audre Lorde says, the erotic is knowledge and being that has been feared and thus consigned exclusively to the bedroom. So in other words, we often associate erotic with sex or maybe even, you know, unconventional sex or whatever, the erotic. But she's saying, no, it's not really about that. It's about freeing a kind of energy that women have had to contain because of the oppression and the attitudes towards women in our society. So Simone de Beauvoir, who maybe you've heard of Simone de Beauvoir, who was also the first feminist phenomenologist, and she says, she describes women's inhabiting situations of oppression, including women's experiences of subordination, lack of freedom and personal agency. She explores self-rapport as a mode of resistance. She advocates women developing self-rapport as a liberatory practice. As males are held as the subject and females are othered, acts of being for themselves rather than for others is a resistance to this objectification by centering oneself in one's own experience, inhabiting one's own vision rather than exiting through the male gaze, manifesting the liberation of all beings. Now again, I'm offering this as evocative, but I appreciate what she's saying, because for women and for all of us, the feminine in all of us, we've not been free to honor it. And instead, we're trying to accommodate, or we're trying to fit into what's expected of us. And so for us to ground ourselves in our own lived experience that we maybe are still discovering is an act of resistance to the way our culture has defined what it means to be feminine, what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a man. I'm especially interested now to move to a discussion, but maybe just to say what I think is important in another way, that this wild feminine spirit really involves this mystical marriage between our adamantine engagement with life, with the human condition, with the suffering of animals, saving the earth, everything that's mundane and sort of ordinary about life. And at the same time, we're staying intimate with our bodily wisdom that's opening to create and be creative in every moment. So we're birthing the wisdom and compassion emerging in the moment all the time, or that would be our intention. I think I just want to end with a poem by Mary Oliver, because I feel like she also characterizes what we're talking about. And she says, to live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal, to love what is mortal, to hold on to this love and this mortal against your bones, knowing your own life depends on this love. And yet when the time comes, to let it go, to let it go. So it's passionate love, holding on to life and then letting it go. Thank you so much for listening. And this is just my perspective, and many people are here. Offer what comes up for them.
Quite a lot that you put out there. That's quite a lot that you put out there, but I always like, you know, the way, even though Rumi is a guy, he just the way he expresses himself as seeing other and all things as the beloved, right? And I really enjoy that way of imagining that everything is the beloved. If you can just approach everything as the beloved, then that's a big job. That's all I have to say.
Yeah. And yes, what you're saying is that's what it's all about.
Okay. He actually rejoices in it and dances with it.
Yeah.
Writes poems about it.
I don't know if you could find it again, but I love that quote from Simone de Beauvoir, and the word that jumped out of it, out of that quote for me was self-rapport, and it seems like sums up your talk to me, and what you're saying about this embodied awareness, and I think what we can say about our meditation is that it's, you know, it's a deep self-rapport of, you know, all our experience, not, you know, whether it be pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, whatever it is, you know, we're there with, in self-rapport with what's coming up, you know, and it corresponds, I think, to the teaching of that we hear about intimacy, being intimate with everything, with your life and how it's coming into you every moment. And I think that, you know, to encourage people to not be afraid of self-rapport, you know, that this is part of what we should be doing. We should be in self-rapport. And then, and when we're really in self-rapport, it seems like we can extend that, you know, to rapport with, you know, other people and earth and politics and religion and whatever it is.
It's the stream that flows within and all around and out.
Yeah.
That's what's so incredible about it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
This reminds me of some a text that I've been studying, and it's written by a woman lama, with, you know, strings and, you know, lots and lots of credentials and transmissions and, you know, I mean, she's been practicing for 60, 70 years. And she tells a story of one of her main teachers who kept stopping her in her tracks when she was with him. She'd be doing something, and he would walk into the room and he would say, "Stop pretending." Just to, you know, just blurt it out, and she'd just go, "Wah." And but it worked on her, worked on her, and he kept doing it over, you know, years, and it worked on her and worked on her. Just what am I, what's pretending? Why am I pretending? Am I pretending? What am I, you know, just this really provocative statement. Mm-hmm. And it takes great courage. Mm-hmm. And lots of sitting and lots of time. Yeah. To stop pretending. Yeah. That's what, and that just, you know, was, I didn't think of that on the retreat, but I did think of it tonight.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And it is also just this, you know, it's staying exactly with how it is right now. Because we're not the fixed self, right? But at the same time, to be that authentically just this has to be learning these languages of listening inside. And Dogen talks about, don't get caught in the image of yourself. You know, don't let that be how you think you are.
Yeah.
And it's sort of the same idea of what you're talking about. Oh, well, let's see. Andrea, hello. You have to unmute yourself.
Hi.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you hear me now? Okay. Okay. Hi. Thank you. I really enjoyed the retreat, and I enjoyed listening to your presentation tonight, Doralee, and what everyone has offered in response. What inspired me and what you had shared this evening is talking about the feminine spirit or this feminine energy as not being gender specific or biologically specific. And so if we're talking about it in those terms, what other way could I frame my understanding of the feminine spirit? And as a, you know, self-identified feminist, I appreciate being challenged in that way, breaking out of the duality dynamic of feminine, masculine, you know, woman, man, patriarchy, and the resistance kind of more political dynamics. And so what I draw upon is what I've learned through my yoga teacher trainings, which is this feminine energy that is passive and receptive, as we would practice in yin yoga, as opposed to maybe vinyasa flow yoga, where we're doing a lot of heating activities. And so then that brings to mind an image of water. And thinking about it in terms of maybe like a stream or a river, you know, that feminine energy being the water and the more masculine energy being the boulders that are in the middle of the river, the banks of that river. And something that we had even talked about in retreat is, you know, we are not here practicing as wild women to denigrate or in any way devalue the masculine presence that has worked so hard to establish this practice and even provide the space that we were in there at Green Gulch. So to practice the wild feminine, I think, is to go deeper into our faith and to acknowledge and appreciate the masculine and then continue to flow around it for deeper seeking. I think in the spirit of Buddha's free inquiry that he teaches to us. I'm not really sure if it's called the doctrine of free inquiry or what the scholastic term is, but I think you guys know what I'm talking about. And so, yeah. And so that's how I like to embrace it. And I'll share that with you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm curious, I mean, how does that definition fit or sit with those of you who are of the male biological identity?
Dr. Lee, I have a question.
Okay.
What comes to mind when you hear women are from Venus, men are from Mars? I think there's something to that, but I don't know where to go from there. Any thoughts?
Well, I mean, could you say a little more about what that something is? You say there's something to it, so it's resonating with something in you that maybe knows something there?
That might be that men like to make war and women like to nourish the earth.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So where we go from there, I don't know.
Well, that's a good question. And yeah, and I guess it's hard a little bit to keep the duality of male-female in that conversation because, you know, the feminine is a form, is an energy that's available to everyone. So maybe the question has more to do with how can that energy, you know, become more powerful in the lives of our society.
My personal goal is to become a grandmother.
Yay! Yay! Yeah, that's what Dogen says too. Grandmother mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other? Oh, let's see. Simone.
Hi, can you guys?
We can hear you.
There we go. Yeah. Oh. I don't know how I'm appearing, but yeah, I so wanted to be here, but unfortunately, it looks like I might have the flu, so that's why I'm not there. But I loved your presentation, Dorley, and I really appreciated your emphasis on embodiment and connecting with the feelings instead of rejecting them or not being attached to them. So I'm currently doing this Theravadin practice where it's the idea is to kind of basically reject everything, not cling to anything, including feelings and even the body. Yet you're supposed to be anchored in the body. So I'm having a bit of difficulty with that. But I want to echo what Andrea says about, I know you're talking about the feminine masculine duality. I just have some problems with that. I mean, to say yes, it's has nothing to do with biology, but yet we're using classical sort of binary definitions of feminine and masculine. So it's just something that I have an issue with. Yeah, that's all. But I love the inquiry. Sorry, I was not at the retreat. So. that's about it. But just, yeah, the binary and what I would label as essentialist, that's the term that kind of almost resorts to stereotypes, even though we're saying it's, you know, beyond biology. So anyway, that's it. That's my comments. Thanks.
Okay. I didn't tend to keep it as a duality, but to more open up this kind of energy that's available for all of us. And what might be challenging for you to be open to it too, because that's, you know, part of the whole thing. Like, sometimes it feels scary to me, for example. So, You know, it's more like we're here to invite a kind of entrance into an exploration. Because even with Audre Lorde's definition, which I really appreciated, because she says, if I can get back there, the erotic is a resource within each of us rooted in the power of our unexpressed or unrecognized feeling. So I feel like she's pointing to a capacity that's in all of us, a power, she calls it, that, you know, because of our culture and the way we're conditioned, you know, we haven't connected fully there yet. Feels like it's an invitation, and that I see what we're doing here as, you know, sort of starting a journey or something, you know, to help us all cultivate another way of listening, another way of being that, you know, is rooted in the Dharma. And it's more our cultural mores and all of that that's sort of in the way. But it would mean that we can, you know, find safe places to do that kind of exploring and inquiring together for, you know, men and women. Yes, Jody.
I had a similar reaction that Simone had, and I've really been thinking about that, and I think...
Put the mic close to
you. Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now? So I've really been thinking about that, and I think some of it is, for me anyway, is rooted in, you know, this very deep conditioning that the feminine is worthless and bad, and that is in me very deeply, and that comes from, you know, all kinds of sources. So that even though intellectually and in lots of ways I don't believe that, I don't think that's true, but there's still this really deep place where it's like accepting that the feminine is hard. And some of the softer attributes of that energy, which it does feel very stereotypical to talk about, oh, the feminine is the soft side of the yin, all that. But I wonder if some of that reaction and is really due to this deep conditioning that is like, oh, something that's soft and pliable is bad, right? Or not acceptable, or that kind of thing. So that's my question for me about that stuff.
It's a question you're bringing to yourself too, because you're owning and acknowledging that as women and men, we're conditioned in these ways to create these stereotypes of men and women, and often the women's stereotypes are more negative, or like soft is weak or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's all part of, you know, like deconstructing, I guess, or in becoming aware, and how do we work with these so that we can access this other capacity, you know, for passionate life.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dorothy. A couple of things that are that I'll take away, at least. One is the idea of the feminine and masculine, whatever they are, energy, being discernible from each other, but not necessarily associated with gender. Just kind of it's like a deeper sense of what those energies might be that transcend the usual masculine, feminine, and the other is the lovely metaphor that Andrea mentioned of masculine and feminine energy being like the water and the river bed or bank, because there's such a stark distinction between water and rocks. One flows and is very labile and soft, the other is very hard and rigid. And it's kind of a metaphor for all kinds of dualities. But the river and its bed shape each other. They're completely a function one of the other. So there's a synthesis there in, you know, what we call a river. We normally think that system that is a living thing, really. So it's just such and the notion of the erotic as being a function of our untrammeled emotions, that's a different and deeper concept of the erotic of that energy than I normally attribute to it. It's like the life energy itself, I think, that may be what she's talking about. So use the word evocative before. It's a very evocative talk. Thank you.
I appreciate your word untrammeled, actually, because that sort of captures a lot of, I think, these messages we're talking about too, is, you know, certain parts of ourselves that have been trammeled, either by ourselves and our social conditioning or society. And that untrammeledness is often something we're not even conscious of, you know, because we haven't really learned how to process underneath all of that. And yet that's the thing, you know, with emotions, they each have a life, but they move and flow and open. And I love what Zenju says, cry until you stop crying. That everything has its life, its dharma, and, you know, we have the capacity to let all that live, and but, you know, we need each other. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for everything that everyone shared, and thank you again for the retreat. It was very special for me in that not only did I get to experience my wild self, but I got to see that I'm capable of change. Because when I went in there to the retreat, it wasn't just the concepts and the theme of the retreat, but it was just the overall experience. Getting out of my daily routine, being with people I don't know, confronting my fears of, you know, creating what was that play we created, the Cohen play, and, you know, all of these things that are so out of my normal day-to-day experiences, that was cathartic. And an agent of change for me, just that in and of itself. And I realized that I can do these things. I can, you know, like I said, get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and meditate with those monks before I've had my coffee. I did not know I was capable of that. And not only did I do it, but I enjoyed it. So just little things like that to me were what I've kept. And I keep hearing the words to myself that I hear, I can do these great things. To me, that was great. That was a wonderful thing to be able to do that, because my heart yearns to be able to get up super early in the morning and meditate and do my prayers and get in touch with my inner self, my Buddha nature. But there's so many obstacles and so many afflictions, but I can do it. I proved that to myself on the retreat.
Yeah, wonderful. I mean, just to break out of our, you know, the limitations we impose on ourselves, really. We can't do this, we can't do that, we're too old for this, we're too old for that. All of those things that come in, and it's sort of like, no. You know, we're much more than we think we are. And just to break out, you learn that. Yeah, wonderful.
And that took...
It took courage.
It took the Sangha.
Oh, uh-huh.
It took the Sangha, and it took your leadership. So thank you, everyone.
I think Dave, did you want to? Oh, Trina.
Thank you also for the retreat. It was a wonderful time to just be able to be and to be present with the Sangha and be in that space. Tonight I find myself thinking about the metaphor of the river more, as it's been mentioned over and over, and I was just finding it very useful to think about how there are parts of me that are hard and solid. And I can think of that in a positive way, of things about me that I can count on and know, but also things that maybe I've wanted to change or worked with, and it's still kind of solid and keeps being there. Mm-hmm. And yet I'm also flowing in and around and with these aspects of myself, that there's always both. There's always the solid and the moving and the flowing. And I hadn't thought about that before tonight, but that metaphor of those two parts of ourselves, however you label them, is something that I'll keep thinking about. So thank you for that.
And thank you, because you're also describing a kind of attention again, because we can have what I call grabby attention, you know, like where, you know, I'm going to give attention to this because I want to change this, or something like that, because you notice the hard, for example. But you were in the sort of open, you know, allowing, you know, this hardness in you to be here, and this flowy, and just holding it off. And that kind of attention too is, you know, supportive of change.
And the solid is sometimes positive.
And that's positive, right. Yes, yes, yes. So you don't want to label it as negative either.
They're just both there, mm-hmm. and working together.
Working together. Yeah. Great. Dave.
Water in a riverbank, when connects with gravity, becomes a very powerful force. It can wear down the rock to nothing over time. The rock cannot wear down the water. I'm not sure what that means, but we started talking about rivers and banks and rocks, and all that just kind of came to mind. So, but it seems to work somehow or another. I'm just not sure how.
Yeah. So yeah, more evocative. Yeah. Yeah, I think I saw it up hand.
Yeah, thanks, Dorley. A couple of things. I think of the book, Don't Push the River, It Flows by Itself, which was one of my favorite books long ago. And also that what I liked about the retreat too is that I liked the way we were able to be at Green Gulch and participate with Green Gulch, I mean, and the ceremonies there. But interweaving then other ways of expression, I guess, of appreciating the body. I mean, I know Rebbe's said that, well, Zazen is about the body, you know. I mean, it's a yoga. Anyway, I guess that's about all I need to say.
Yes,
thank you.
Different avenues.
I know, but I just wanted to mention that a monk at Green Gulch told me that she was quite impressed by you all sitting in the Zendo. She thought you had good posture and were sitting quite nicely.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. Yay.
What higher commendation. I would just like to commend to you the science of fluvial hydrogeomorphology. This is a study of how water and earth interact to make fluvial systems, riverine systems. The rocks, the earth, completely channel the water and direct it. And the earth and the water completely forms the banks during flood stage. And fluvial geomorphology is the physics, mostly, of that interaction. So, you know, people can predict what's going to erode away and wash the town away and so forth. That's its practical utility. But I was just so struck. I am so struck by that, by analogizing that to feminine and masculine. I hesitate to use the labels, but what can I do? Those different energies that just really you can't think of one without the other. You can't have a river without a water and its banks and the river banks. And there's an intimate transmission now that I think of it.